coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody, and happy Tuesday night. Hope everybody has been doing well as we come up to the 25th anniversary of 9/11. Very sad that I won't be at the 9/11 conference this year. I will say that was one of the we've now covered as of MUFON. We have now covered 30 live conferences with Curious Realm, and it is amazing. It's fantastic. We love going out and talking to the researchers, the presenters, things like that. To whoever is trying to enter the waiting room right now, please know that it is a private Zoom. So you will not be admitted to the waiting room of the Curious Realm Zoom, folks. So just so you are aware, that bandwidth is reserved for the live broadcast. So sorry, please do feel free to join us on YouTube on curiousrealm.com/live every week on Tuesdays. You can also join us in replay format on the Ground Zero Media Network. Also I'd like to say a big hearty thank you and farewell to our good friend, Ron Patton. He was the network producer and producer for Clyde Lewis and Ground Zero. He was a good friend of the show. Brought us onto that network, and he unfortunately passed while we were out speaking at MUFON. And he was a great friend. He was a great guy. He really stood for a lot of amazing things. So it's always sad whenever we lose somebody like that in the industry, whenever somebody with such an amazing resonant voice is no longer with us. But Clyde is still out there. He is still doing things. He has a new producer, Rich, who is also with the network. Welcome, Rich. So you can catch us there, all kinds of fun stuff. In the second part, speaking of 9/11 and our lack of being able to be at the Turning the Tide 9/11 conference this year, we will be welcoming Richard Gage in the second part to talk about 9/11 25 years later, what the impact of that was, what some of the things... The mayor of New York just released a bunch of stuff, including things on WTC7, possibly today. So all kinds of things coming out about that. So stay tuned in the second part for Richard joining us. In the first part, we are so happy to welcome back our good friend Yusuf Nasari. He is with CCertainty.com, Carbonic Certainty. His new book is Carbonic Artistry, Breathing Beyond Self into the Cosmic Symphony. And this is a concept that I have spoken about to numerous people over the last few years. Welcome back, Yusuf. How are you doing?
Oh. So much for appreciate you.
Oh, absolutely, man. And like I said in the pre-show, and like I just said, this is a concept that I have spoken to numerous people about over the last couple of years. The idea, and I met you, you had a table set up at the International Remote Viewing Association conference in Charlotte, Virginia, a few years ago. And that is where we met. That's where I had you on the show shortly after. And then again, but to know that you have gone through now and written the book, that you were out there with this, it's so fantastic. And this book literally released a couple weeks ago. It hit my doorstep today. I am about 75 pages in. My target is always 100. It's always one of those, I love telling a guest, I've read the first 100 pages of your book. I have questions from there. I want you to tell us the rest. but before we get into the rest, before we get into the book, Yusuf, how did you come to this concept? How did you come to this world of study to begin with? What brought you to this deep spiritual concept of carbonic artistry?
Yeah, thank you for that question. You know, you almost call it a concept. I like to say this is one of the concept-less, idea-less remembering. I will assure you this book will not aim to teach anyone who reads it anything, but it will sort of be remembered, sort of like once someone reads this book, the content has a tendency to make a reader remember what they already know. So sort of the book reflects almost a mirror. Now, why? Well, every one of us is breathing, and with that comes exhalation. And we today, science knows that each time we exhale, there are organisms even within us that leaves certain biomarkers that are unique to that organism. They are able to detect cancer in some level. They're able to detect certain diseases now a lot better than ever before. In fact, in Germany, they now have certain fans or some sort of a suction around the Black Forest to determine the health of the forest and the animals and the trees by literally the biomarkers in the CO2 that are able to leave things to the scientists, information about depopulation of the fox or a particular bird dying out, certain information. So everyone is able to connect to this idea that my exhale is a communication. Now, the question of how did this realization arrive to me? Well, it goes back, quite honestly, to about 20 and half years ago, to be exact, 20 years and 6 months and 2 weeks almost. And the reason I remember it so precise is because by profession, I'm a lawyer and I go to court. And I came home one day, 20 years and a half ago, and my daughter was 5 months old or so. And regular day, I come home and I kiss my daughter. She was on the floor. I picked her up. I kissed her. I put her back in the crib. And in that moment, something in her eyes delivered me to something I had never seen or felt before, an epiphany of some sort. And then by the time I put her head down, I realized this is something, it was a paradigm shift for me. So it put me in a pursuit of what was that? What was that? I became stupefied. I literally witnessed in a way an unselfing. There are many ways I can describe it, but at the end, none of the words would ever really serve me well. But I know it triggered the lawyer in me to try to say, well, what, this got to be repeatable. This can't be just some sort of a, you know, I couldn't limit myself to any concept, any ideas that was limiting. I needed something bigger than that. So I went through meditation, I went through reading various, religion, poetry, every direction. But it really, ultimately, every step that I took, it just took me deeper and deeper and deeper. And just to fast forward, essentially, there came a time just about 5 years ago, 4.5 years ago, right when I started writing this book, right before that, where I went to a deep meditation. By the way, I went to Japan. I lived in a temple, lived in a monastic life for a while. I did various techniques, Zazen and various Sufism, my whirling, just all kinds of things I pursued out of curiosity, some of it out of just unfolding of my path. But it brought me to a point where suddenly I'm in a deep meditation where it feels to the people around me that I'm no longer breathing, and they are concerned about actually my health, and maybe I have died, and maybe they even almost started CPR, and a couple of people cried. But it had been apparently 6 minutes or so where I had stopped breathing, and the breath was taking me, quite honestly. And I had never experienced this. I was fully aware. And what was happening to me was that my muscles in my body, I was quite observant of it, had become completely so relaxed. And the two muscles that are really so impossible to relax normally is the esophagus. Mm. And even that had become relaxed in a way that this whole thing had become a duck. You know how, let's say, if you're in a cave and the hot air and the cold air creates a duck circulation? Yeah, yeah. So I could feel the breath going in and coming out, snaking itself. So I had no knowledge of this prior to that. Later on, I go and come to find out Kundalini operates like this in some ways exactly. And that's what had happened to me. And I was in that minute. So they started doing CPR on me. And then, of course, they realized I'm not dead. I'm still alive. But I couldn't, my body, everything was almost in a paralysis.
Interesting.
So my finger, just my finger, I moved it. And they then stopped. And took me a while. I came back to my body. Then it, you know, it just went through an integration of that profound experience, and took me about 6 months at least, where I was integrating this experience. It was vaster, bigger than I had ever. I called that when I came back, I called that termination. I called that, I couldn't call it death. I had passed the light. I had already seen several times through previous meditation a light, and I went through. And this time I'm like, no, I don't want to be in here. I'm going to pass it. And I went through the complete blackout, and I call that a termination state.
Huh.
And when I came back, so to speak, it there's a whole journey of it. But it was so profound that I went to my kids and I told them that, quite honestly, I said to them that your dad is no longer here. It's an avatar that is occupying this body. I am including your dad, but bigger, and do not no longer limit me as to your dad. I'm being so again. That integration expanded beyond me into my family and into my life. Quite honestly, through that integration, I did not want to adhere to any concepts and ideas, because what happened was, as I started to meditate again, I began to experience things in this physical limitation that was manifesting outside of my physical limitation. And so in other words, this physical limitation that I was occupied in as a body was somehow registering through my meditation something outside. And I'm like, wait a minute, that can't be. How is that possible? So this continued to be part of my integration. And I didn't want to adhere to religiosity, concepts, ideas,
yeah,
soul, or those things that I felt like it could be all of that, but I got to go beyond that. So suddenly, in one meditation particularly, I was in Spain at that time, I come to this realization that, wow, the only thing that it can be has to be carbon. Carbon, can carbon be a platform that can hold information that gets out and performs a function that is in reciprocity to this experience that the body is now registering from the outside manifestation? So as I went deeper and deeper, I have not been able to really dismiss that. That's all I can tell you. I have been able to simply confirm in my own ways, non-scientific and yet quite remembering, quite primitive in my remembering, that that we are always the shadow of our own truth. So this idea that the carbon takes my information out, and with the process that happens, We are kindled every time informatically and perceptively. So, yes, sir, I hope I've answered some of that curiosity.
And, you know, it's interesting, the concept of termination that you're talking about. I regularly have a crystal with me, and that is the point of a crystal. That is the point at which things have grown together to literally a different point, Yusuf. And the idea, let's start getting into this carbonic reality concept. There is a great part here at the very beginning that I want to read to the audience that talks about chapter one. And it's referring to carbon. We explore its role as a cosmic messenger, a molecule that bridges the material and spiritual realms. Each exhalation carrying CO2 becomes more than a physiological function. It transforms into a sacred act of connection, offering your essence to the infinite. This chapter unveils the scientific, mystical, and poetic dimensions of CO2, guiding you to see each breath as a living bridge between self and cosmos. And I, just after going through and listening to our last two conversations since we booked this, and then reading that, that is a beautiful synopsis of this whole teaching, really, that you have a chance to be reborn with every breath. You have a chance to, every bit of negativity in your body, everything that you're feeling, you have a chance to lock that in to the CO2 that you were exhaling and just get rid of it. Get rid of it and begin reprogramming yourself with the next inhale. And that is one of the most beautiful concepts in the world, man.
Yeah, and you know, not only you're getting rid of it, but you are aware that by getting rid of it, you're allowing them each thought, each thing you're letting go to serve their purpose. And therefore, their purpose is always to bring back a reciprocity in a way that purifies or brings purity and clarity to your heart.
Yeah.
So you're not letting go of anything that is not beneficial. Ultimately, everything comes back to you.
Yeah. No, exactly. And even the idea spiritually, and this is a tough idea for a lot of people to get into, Yusuf, but the idea specifically in Buddhism, things like that, and in Indian philosophies, the anger is righteous, that it's okay that you're angry. What you're not supposed to do is give it safe harbor. Safe passage. You aren't supposed to give it a bed to sleep in. You know, your anger probably comes from the fact of either you or somebody you know or love has been wronged in some way. So it's okay to feel the anger in that root chakra kind of way, but it's not okay to let that anger creep its way up through the rest of the chakras. You know, you're supposed to process it, get rid of it, exhale it, do other things, put it out into the universe in some kind of write a song about it, whatever. But you're supposed to transform and transmute that in some kind of way into something positive, even if it's an idea of how you take in and process anger.
Yes. And now allow me to take this Please. One step further, because if we limit it to this idea that there is an I capable to prevent this movement of anger through the chakras, and this I has to perform in a certain way or function in a certain way, then remember, Chris, we just limited it again. But if we allow an anger to remain as whatever it wants to be, if we allow the consciousness of anger to be separate and not connected to the narrative of the person that holds me, then the person dies into the anger and becomes anger. It's no longer a person who is experiencing anger and therefore reacts in a certain way. No, you realize anger wants to be, and you just become that without any any personality attached to it. So you're, and then once you know, and once you're able to do that, the anger will perform its function because you're no longer attaching a narrative. And its function is always a resolve, okay, from the karmic entanglement into a resolve, what we call in my book, an absolute resolve. An absolute resolve. In the book, if I may, have a glossary. And in the glossary, I just want to read the word absolute resolve as a definition.
Okay.
That gives us an idea. In fact, it's the first word in the glossary, and it says absolute resolve is a noun. It's a core law. Absolute resolve is the inherent, non-negotiable momentum of unity expressed through the breath. Okay? So absolute resolve, let me read again, is the inherent, non-negotiable momentum of unity. So we know there is no separation, so there is a unity out there that is perceptively is hard for us to perceive it with the mind. So because our mind creates a separation and then seeks unity. But the default of unity itself is a momentum that is non-negotiable. What is that non-negotiable? Is that it says here, to be expressed through the breath. It is not chosen or generated. It is the underlying directive that governs the dissolution of separation in every exhalation. Elaboration. Absolute resolve operates prior to will, prior to intention or identity. It is the organizing intelligence that ensures all fragmented expressions return to coherence. Okay? So absolute resolve, then, it's a sort of like a consciousness that is embedded in every disparity of the from the unified field of consciousness.
Okay. I guess kind of in Christian terms, that would almost be like sufficient grace. Where there is always a salvific part that exists. There is always a means to salvation. There's always a means by which to be able to redeem something in that kind of way.
Exactly. Except the word always, we can kind of eliminate it because we are in a timeless vacuum. So therefore, it's almost inevitable to escape from that salvation because we are salvation, except we attach a narrative and then we get lost, sort of like that.
Well, and let's get into that real quick because that is another part that I actively have highlighted. Let me find that real quick. Here it is right here. Surrender does not negate the self, but rather transforms it, revealing the no-self as the luminous foundation of all beings. Like carbon, which exists as the backbone of all life, yet remains invisible in its essence. The no-self supports the whole while transcending individuality. Again, exhalation is this light. In this light becomes the immovable piece of Nisar. Where stillness and surrender dissolve into unity beyond self. And it's interesting because there is a concept that I've been trying to teach people over the last year and a half that just came to me one day. And it was really a keep your lane concept. And truly so much of what we get into ego-wise in the world, Yusuf, is because we choose not to keep our lane. You know,
in terms of,
it's spiritually, whatever, doesn't matter. Most of our pains come from the fact that we have chosen to step into a river that we probably should not be treading in, you know? And once we learn to realize that and just to keep our lane with what we're supposed to do, doesn't matter if it's your job, your spiritual practice, whatever, things just work out. And it's very interesting, but it's the idea that, delegation of responsibility is not abdication of authority. You know, yeah. The idea that just because you've delegated responsibilities to somebody, and they may be your responsibilities, it's your responsibility to make sure the job gets done. Absolutely. But the fact that you've delegated that does not absolve you of your accountability and authority over the situation. It doesn't mean that you've advocated your authority to anybody, you know, in that kind of way, or that you've advocated your agency whatsoever.
What is the connection to that you're making now?
The idea of surrender, that idea of the release of surrender in that kind of way, where you don't have to have that. You don't have to choose that. You don't have to choose attachment to that. You don't have to choose attachment to your ego or bruising to your ego because you have relinquished something to somebody. You know, that's a beautiful release if you learn to see it that way.
Indeed. You know, I thought actually you're going to take me to the part of the book that is about the story of Adam and Eve retold. Have you gotten to that part? No, not yet.
Not yet. But let's
whole story of Garden of Eden. And so let me tell you. Let's say I invite you and say, let's go to a garden. I know it's a special garden. Okay. And you say, yeah, Yusuf, let's go. I say, Christopher, come on. And we go. We're walking in the garden. And we see in the middle of the garden the tree. And I tell you, listen, this is the tree of knowledge. You say, oh, what are you talking about? This is not the Garden of Eden. So why are you calling? I said, no, really, this is the Garden of Eden. You're like, okay, what is this special about this garden? And I walk you to the tree. And when we walk to the tree, instead of an apple tree, which the Old Testament or the story of Adam and Eve is referencing, instead of an apple tree, it happens to be a tree of knowledge. It looks like an apple tree. But instead of an apple hanging from its branches is O2, oxygen. It looks like an apple, almost. But it's actually O2. Now, let's say I take this O2 because I haven't breathed yet and we're in the garden. We don't require oxygen yet. We're still in a very primitive sort of way of non-separation. Our awareness, our consciousness is no longer, has not yet primed itself for separation. We are in the garden of God, so to speak. We are in the garden of non-separation. We walked into it. You said yes, and we walked in there. Yeah. And then I pick a fruit. I call it O2, and you bite into it, and you become alive. You breathe the oxygen. Now, if you bite into that apple and say, I am Yusuf, and attach all your narratives, well, you just bit into the apple, you will be kicked out of the garden.
Yeah.
But if you take this oxygen in, recognize that it's supposed to do what it does, and no narrative, let it go. There is no, the I am, just like Moses, for example, God responded. So I am, just pause right there, nothing, no narrative. Let the I am pause, and then the I vanishes, and then there's just am. At that point, you're no longer going to be feeling like you got kicked out of the garden, because you still feel connected to the oneness and the singularity of the garden, even though it is today, 2026. And apparently the garden, if it was a historic place or a location on a map, it is no longer necessary for us to be limited to that. It is right here.
Yeah.
The tree of knowledge is the oxygen you take in every time.
Well, and especially that concept of tying yourself to the carbon that you are exhaling, putting that out, is a very unique concept in that, if you look back at, older than biblical tradition, if you look back into Hebrew mysticism, things like that, Kabbalistic teaching, there is the idea that we participate in the divine, that we uniquely, because the universe was spoken into being, life breathed into it, that when we breathe, when we speak, things come into being, that we uniquely take part in that creative vibration which is why words hurt more than actions, you know, things like that. But when you start looking at that, when you start considering the fact that, yes, we create with every word in that kind of way, that we are in a way creating another part of reality every time that we exhale, every time that we put our vibration into the universe, we are creating a unique vibration that's there. And we'll like a bell, will never be unrung.
Yes, because we tend to breathe out information that is more aligned in the conundrum, more aligned with the limitation of time and space. And therefore, when we exhale that type of information out, sort of like, I got to go a place, I have a deadline, I can't pay my bill, or all these things that ratifies my narrative, instead of the idea of letting go, because ultimately this exhalation is my, I have no guarantee that the next exhale is coming. I can't file a complaint. I can't go to file a complaint department and say, well, ain't hell, where did it come? Why didn't it come? You know, so therefore, my perceptively, I can accept that regardless of all the stress that I have in this very second, if I can hack the system by simply saying, I got to save my bills, but you know what, hold on. Release that exhale without the vibration of the mental capacity that is imprinting that stress and inflammatory way on the carbon, right? When you do that, then what happens, the absolute resolve no longer needs to show reciprocity. So yes, it is true that every time we exhale, we create a world that needs to be concerned about how do we snap out of it? How do we get out of our own conundrum? And we just made it more complicated. So in response, absolute resolve has to come up with additional narrative that we experience in the upcoming future, so to speak, in the passing moment, to allow me an opportunity to snap out of my own limitation, my own mess I made. But if I begin to exhale by this idea that I have no I have no inhale guaranteed to me, I am able to let go perceptively. And when that stress is gone, when all of those self-imprinting is gone, absolute resolve sort of like doesn't have a job to do. Sort of like now you're touching Dharma. Now you begin to add mass in your dharmic realm. If some of your audience want to know what is karma, what is dharma,
please.
My way of saying it in my own simple way is that if you turn a candle on, and what is moving is the flame. The flame is moving all the time, and it almost like attracts our eyes to it. We almost like stare at it and enjoy the light and the shadow that gets created. And if you say, what is Dharma with respect to this event, this candle and its flame and the movement of the shadow and light, I would say, listen, look at what is not moving. Look at around the flame. Look what's not moving. That's Dharma. Okay? And we are all a burning candle. Okay? We are all a filament that, just like a candle that has a wax and a wick, and they evaporate into thin air.
Yeah.
Once the candle is gone, the wax is gone, the wick is gone, but the light remains forever. It's just going to continue on. And in the same way, we are that candle. We have a wick and we have a wax. And what we let go through our exhalation and emanation of our heart and vibrations and frequencies of our mind is that flame. Now, if we keep thinking we are this movement, I am this, I am that, we miss the point that I inversely is where my truth is. So that's the dharmic realm. When we add mass to our dharmic realm, then magnetic field changes. Suddenly you attract different reality.
Now, how does that mass get added? How do we imprint that on the dharmic realm, Yusuf?
There's only one thing ever there is ever to do. It's awaken to the fact that there is only am, there is no I am, and therefore there's no narrative. If the idea that I am is all we have to ever do, okay? Because our perceptively, am itself becomes difficult to grasp.
Yeah.
So you settle with your mind, you make a deal. Say, okay, fine, let's just don't make any narrative. I'll just add the word I. And we just pause. Okay. The mind says, okay, I am, and we pause right here. And then you settle and meditate on that. And you and your I begin to notice the I is vanishing because it is not real.
Yeah.
So when you go to a slow meditation, the clarity of your heart will shine. Your mind will become an observer of what is shining. And you suddenly remember there is no I. Because it's so limited, it's just the am. I am the wall. I am the air. I'm the matter. I'm the antimatter. And it's just that. So the more you are, your mind becomes submissive to that, the more mass you will gain in the dharmic realm.
Well, and you know, with that in mind, that actually echoes another part that I have set up here, and that is. In the journey from individuality to unity, ego often acts as a narrator of separation, a storyteller that frames all experience within the walls of I. But ego is not inherently an obstacle. Rather, it's a stage, a scaffold that allows the self to recognize its limitations. Through the breath, ego is not rejected. It's alchemized. And that idea of loss of ego, that idea of not getting caught up in yourself, not getting remembering that the ultimate point is to get to the am, not the I, get past the I to the point of just am, and understanding that you are a unique frequency within the chord of the universe. And without your frequency, without your unique note, the chord does not ring the same, you know? And that's why that's how you're part of the am. In that kind of way, but how do you keep from not taking it to that next step of question, which is, am I, Yusuf? How do you stop the ego from taking it to that point?
When we say the idea of I am, and then when we quiet in this, when we go in our quietude, we recognize naturally that the I vanishes. It almost can be said that it vanishes, but not to its detriment. It vanishes because it remembers it is another pixel in the am.
Mm.
So it's not a suicide for an ego to say, oh, I don't exist and therefore I don't even shouldn't be here.
Yeah.
No, the ego finds its position as another pixel in the am. And that idea I call a submissive mind. A submissive mind will no longer fight perceptively with the separation as its momentum. It is now submissive that while there is a separation, there is an inevitable non-separating am, yeah, that is part of its nature.
Well, yeah, and that idea that much like any organism in a greater system, yes, while you are individual, you are also part of that greater system.
Yes.
That organically moves and shifts and changes, as sometimes you're slightly to the left of where you just were. But if you're so rigid that you can't move slightly to the left and still operate properly, there's going to be a problem.
That's for sure. Yes, you continue on that drag.
Now, one of the ideas that I love from this is the idea of the diamond self. The idea of... because diamonds are just 100% carbon. So we have this opportunity to cosmically and karmically create a beautiful and pure diamond self in that kind of way. And I brought up ether diamonds. It crossed my mind today that, like, no, there are actively companies out there right now, Yusuf, that are making diamonds out of carbon dioxide in the air, out of what we are exhaling, out of us every day, out of what we are putting into the universe. They are compressing it into diamonds. So, like, it is totally sound. It's out there. There is a diamond Yusuf out there right now.
It's in front of us. I'm telling you. You know, we see charcoal, right? And we see charcoal is carbon. We see diamond is carbon. They're both carbon. One is pure, and one is impure. The impure carbon, it actually, you put it in front of a sun, it becomes hot. It actually energizes, and it becomes even, it's capable to burn and create. On the other hand, you put a pure carbon in front of a light, it's the only element that doesn't heat up. All 100% of the light passes through. That's why we call it pure carbon. Yeah. It's a very unique element. So now imagine that when we breathe out, we have either carbon as a charcoal that we are exporting into the symphony of cosmos, or we are doing the purity of a diamond. Well, if you are so tangled up in the conundrums of life with the separation and time, and therefore you are adding more shadows into your own field. On the other hand, if you have a submissive mind, with that submissive mind, your exhale goes into what I call a Nesauric field. A Nesauric field is a field where the energy is aware that it needs to be sacrificed for the next thing. There's no self. It's just the movement. And Nesar is a word where one is sacrificing, but there is no sacrificer. It's just part of the mechanism of cosmos. So
okay.
when we exhale with that awareness, we are adding momentum to that Nesauric field, which is magnetically empowers us.
Well, and is literally a part of chemistry. You know, when you start looking at things, no different than the way that that an oxygen atom bonds with a hydrogen atom, you know, the way that one gives up an atom to join the atomic field of another to make a molecule.
You got it.
There is that same, I guess, syncopatic way in which that has to happen. And if it doesn't happen, then things deprecate and the chemistry just doesn't work. Now, how do we begin to, especially when it comes to, please, what was the, I just lost it.
Yeah. You mentioned diamond, and I want to go back to that. There's a term in the book called diamond biovehicle. It's the recognition, it's the awareness that, we are a biological being. Before I am Yusuf, I am a biological vessel or a vehicle. So bio vehicle, and diamond is the idea that this vehicle is supposed to produce diamond, not charcoal. So I am a diamond bio vehicle whenever I am bringing the awareness of the unselved self. If I may just give you the diamond, the glossary, I have a
go ahead
better of it. I would like, yeah, it says diamond biovehicle. It's a noun. It's a form of transcendence. Diamond biovehicle is the human form of functioning as a transparent medium of transmission, elaboration. Identity no longer distorts perception. The body becomes a calibrated structure through which coherence passes without obstruction. Nothing is held interpreted, or claimed, expression occurs without imprint. As carbon becomes diamond through alignment, the being becomes transmissive through surrender. The body does not generate light, it refracts it. So our aim should be to function as a diamond biovehicle that inspires the use of the individual in us. And then the operative mode of that individuality and its narrative is always under the umbrella of a diamond biovehicle, because there's an awareness and a submissiveness in my mind that I have the potential to export diamond into the symphony of the cosmos or hinder it by my conundrums and elusive perception.
Well, and that's what had slipped my mind, was the submissive spirit, the idea of submission. And I want to explore that a little bit more, because once again, that echoes right back to what I was talking about, which is something that so many people have a personal issue with, Yusuf. And that is the relinquishing of things, the letting go. Whether it's letting go of a problem, whether it's letting somebody else take control, it blows people's minds when I let them know, like, oh no, absolutely not. I let my wife drive everywhere. I have learned to just relinquish control in that way and to not have the need of control of the vehicle. I don't care if she goes left or right necessarily, as long as we get to the place on time, whatever, man.
And you benefit, and yeah. You know, there were benefits, because you're not, you know. So I just remember I had a dog, Chocolate Lab. I love that dog, Justita, and you know, they're Labrador, so they like to fetch, and you know, everyone's got this experience with a dog. The dog picks up his toy, and you want to play with him, but he's got it. He doesn't let go. He in his heart, he wants to play. He wants you to throw it again so he can run and fetch it. But that moment he brings it back, he's still not letting it go, right? Even though he wants to play.
Yeah.
Now imagine our ego is exactly like that, right? You have a trouble letting it go, but you know he's going to throw it out there and you can go fetch it and bring it and have fun. You know that. So we all know that life takes us to the next level.
Yeah.
In fact, when we look at our own life, we say that, my God, I didn't really come here. It seems like I've been brought here. I may have felt that like it, but it's not, right? So that's the idea.
Well, and you know, it's very interesting, because I have had a couple of situations happened very recently to me, Yusuf. And this is an idea that I have, like I told you before the show, like my audience knows, former Catholic seminarian, former youth minister, I spent years and years teaching people spirituality and the difference between religion and spirituality, you know, specifically. And
well, sure.
Like you said, frequently we don't know immediately why we're doing something. Sometimes we're just driven to do it, and sometimes you're just literally surfing that wave of whatever that is. And much like my entering and leaving the seminary, I tell people all the time, it was not for me. And it's not that the experience wasn't for me, it's that it wasn't for me. It was so that I could counsel the three people who later came to me and asked me if they should enter the seminary.
Wow.
Who now wear collars and are great priests. You know, it wasn't for me. It was because those people trusted me enough to come to me and ask me for my experience and what it was like, and should they explore that opportunity spiritually in their life. When I built my old pedal company, I had a guitar pedal modification company. Did it utterly out of boredom, man. Literally, me and my wife were passing ships. I'd come home from broadcast. An hour later, she'd head out to teach comedy till midnight. And that happened for about a year. And I was like, I need something to do after I get home. I'm not just going straight to bed at five in the evening. So I started modifying guitar pedals and building circuits. Now, this business was not amazing. It didn't like, I didn't sell it for tens of thousands of dollars or anything like it. It didn't even make me thousands of dollars over the more than a decade I've had it, Yusuf. Mm. But here lately, I got an email from a mom in Dallas whose son is a musician and is considering a career in circuit building and aerospace. And wow. wants to go into designing circuits for aerospace use. And she asked me, she was like, I find your pedal company very, very inspiring and right up his alley. Would you please write a letter to inspire my son? Like, I'm about to weep right now because it's
that's amazing.
It's one of those, once again, I didn't build it for me. I thought I was.
Yeah.
I thought I was building it for me. And I've thought about shutting that website down so many times, man. So many times, because I just don't have time. And on occasion, somebody still reaches out. But literally, that email came through to me 2 weeks ago. And
how do you feel about the statement, the future comes before the past?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely, ma'am. Because we have, there sometimes stands unique pivotal moments where you have a very unique opportunity to facet your gym.
That's
to add another facet to the gym. And with every facet, that gym sparkles more. You know, like that's just how jewelry cutting and diamond cutting and things like that work, man. So when we have the opportunity to cleave that crystal and do it just right so that it doesn't crack, but it makes it sparkle more beautifully, it's an amazing opportunity. And we do not surrender to that so frequently. We are frozen. We don't know how to react. We don't know if we should react in those moments all too frequently.
Indeed. And the good news is, so we can simplify this for your audience,
please,
that what we are talking about is literally such, it's a very simple concept of letting go. And once you do, the recognition that you really didn't let go of anything, it's already inside of this whole vacuum that you've already in there anyway. In other words, with it, there is an awareness, there is an awakening that we really didn't give up on the ego, we didn't give up on the self. It's just that we have now been able to be a multiverse. You're able to recognize who you are and whatever it is, you know, go get up in the morning, worry about your bills and run to work or family, all these things that we call life. Hold on to that.
Yeah.
Nothing with that has to change. Continue with your hopes and sorrows as they are. But while that is happening, all we've done is inserted an awareness that literally simply says, your next inhale is not guaranteed. So every time you exhale, just have that awareness as part of that life and turbulence. That's all.
Well, and you know, man, that is a beautiful point to consider, because as a fourth degree Knight of Columbus, one of the founding principle of that part of the order is memento mori, tempus fugit. Or tempus fugit, memento mori. Time flies, remember death. And that is the idea of, in every moment, you have the unique opportunity to influence the way the world thinks about you upon your death. Whatever you were just doing, were you doing it for the betterment of mankind? Were you doing it for other people? Were you doing it for selfish reasons? This is going to be the first thing people are going to remember about you, was the last thing you were doing. The last thing you were moving to. And we actually did have a statement from one of our listeners. And that is, let me see. In what way will this guide us in our life? And does that indicate the freedom of will or the opposite? And I would say that it definitely indicates free will, because we have the choice as to what we are exhaling out. We have that unique decision in every point. So what would you say to that question, Yusuf?
I would say, Chris, what we're trying to do is shun time in favor of timelessness, okay? Let's follow certain rules when it comes to carbonic artistry, which is the idea of each exhalation is an artistic act that can never be repeated. Like,
yeah,
just like Picasso, you better put a signature on it, right? You're exhaling, you're very unique. So imagine this idea that, number one, time versus timelessness, we are favoring timelessness. Number two, the idea that death is not something out there,
yeah,
but in each exhalation, it is actually, you can call it a mini death if that's nicer. It has a nicer ring to it. But in reality, each exhale is your absolute termination stage.
Yeah.
You're done. Perceptively, because you're hanging on to time, the next inhale feels like you are in a procession of time. But in reality, no, you didn't. You just terminated. The next inhale, you are recollected as a memory in your perceptive, because what's happening actually is just water of the cornea of your eyes. The book in later chapters shows us that when the information from the exhale comes out, the heart has evolved in a multiverse where it will then, that the emanation, the vibration of the heart outside of the physical body activates the data that was just exhaled, sort of like you are now kindled, lit outside of your physical limitation. The light outside will then shine in the cornea of your eyes, and the perceptive minds, in a very most simplistic way, is reading the vibration with the heart having kindled it. And then perceptively, you think you are a continuing entity from the previous. But the truth is actually something much more simpler and much more profound. There is no reincarnation. It's just carnation, termination,
yeah,
carnation, termination.
Well, and the beautiful thing is that we get to decide the termination. And we got into that in our previous conversations, because the one thing you are biologically impelled to do is breathe in. You have no choice about breathing in.
Or out.
But you have a choice as to what you breathe out.
That's right. The frequency you impact.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You you have a choice to every bit of that suffering, every bit of that moment that you are feeling right now that is horrible in your life. You have a moment to lock that into your carbon and release it.
Yes.
And be done with
it. Say it just awareness. Can we say,
absolutely,
instead of saying you have the choice or you have the power,
yes,
or you have the will,
yeah,
because that makes it more difficult.
Well, and that also involves the ego at that point.
That's right. But if we bring just simply an awareness,
yeah,
that your exhale is going to be interrelated to the cosmos, just that awareness will do magic.
Yes.
Because we don't want a to-do list. We don't want an assignment for the ego.
Yeah.
We just want an awareness of the ego being aware of its own vanishing potential.
Yes. And the fact that it is a greasy cog in a big, greasy universal machine, you know?
Got it. That awareness does justice for us.
Well, and that whole concept, or whole teaching, once again, not even concept, teaching, is so pure and so beautiful in the fact that, once again, we get to terminate that crystal. We get to decide what is crystallized as we send that vibration out into the universe. In that kind of way. And there's a phrase that I use on the show all the time, Yusuf, and that is the fact that we are responsible for every vibration that we bring into a room, you know, and how we process those vibrations, how we do things. how we actively vibrate in the cosmos, because once again, the vibration never ends. It just passes source point, you know.
Correct.
Just because the train passed you doesn't mean it stopped.
Mm-hmm.
It just means that the sound passed you in a Doppler kind of way. And the energy's still continuing. It's still going. That vibration is still out there. And every crystal that we create, every diamond dust that we put out there is out there doing amazing things.
Doing amazing things. And it's almost like all we have to do is stop the interference, stop ourselves as being an interference, because everything else happens in that flow energy. So it's not so much that I have to hang on to a certain principle to make sure that my vibration is a particular way or a particular discipline. That actually is not at all the case. It's the idea that any vibration that arrives, rather than good or bad, rather than me being a judge of it, I will allow that vibration to simply pass through me, and I die into that vibration, whatever it is. But sometimes the vibration does want to come in the form of anger, sometimes in the form of peace. But as long as there's no individuality behind that anger, it's just flowering into an anger, then it does serve its purpose.
Yeah.
And then you're not even part of that. That awareness does so much good for our magnetic field. And also it makes it within our grasp, because we don't have to learn anything. We don't have to read another book. All we have to do is just the awareness that we are a multiverse. Allow all of that happen in the now. You know, we like the word, at least for a long time, the word non-discriminatory, you know, in our politics and our economy.
Yeah.
The now, the very now, this very moment, is the most non-discriminatory moment ever. It allows anger, it allows love, it allows you, it allows the multiverse, it allows everything to be here, including the narrator.
Absolutely.
That we want.
Well, and, you know, it very much reminds me of the Aristotelian concept of nothing, and that there can't be no thing, because by definition there's a thing and no thing. Definition, the two are integrally intertwined in that kind of way. And there was another listener tonight who chimed in on YouTube with, I like the idea of there being no self, just movement as part of the cosmos. It makes the concept behind carbonic artistry much more meaningful to me. And I agree. It is the idea that, once again, we are a beautiful part of that vibration. We are a unique note within the chord of the universe, and we take part in that creation. We have a very specific agency in the universe in which to change the world around us, in which to change the way that we interact and in that biofeedback way, that call and response of the universe, Yusuf.
Indeed.
So as we wrap things here in the next couple minutes, what can people take away from this? How can people begin to, as that first listener asked, how can they begin to incorporate this in their daily thought process? How can they begin to really align themselves with this spiritual goal of carbonic artistry and creating something new with every exhale?
You know, I recommend to begin just sitting, maybe 3 minutes of meditation, where all you do in that 3 minutes, you exhale with this idea that this exhale is my terminable, it's my terminable state, it's my death, it's my mini death. Find a word, but simply meditate on this idea, create your own mantra, anything that after a while, your mind becomes submissive, sort of like lubricating the mind that, yeah, there's no guarantee for the inhale. So let's just know that this exhale could be the last one. And when we do that, even if it's just 3 minutes a day, do it for 3 weeks. When you do that, some magic happens. And I want to explain what is that magic and what is the nature or characteristics of that magic.
Please.
And why is this magic inevitable? Why am I so sure that it will happen? All right. So the magic, first of all, it's magical because it's in reciprocity with you. In other words, it'll be your unique magic based on what your resolve is. So it's very magical for you, and it is undefinable until you actually become the experience of it. Now, why is it inevitable? Why do I say it's inevitable? Because, you know, it's almost biblical. We say that, you know, the truth prevails. And the reason is because if what I tell you, which is the idea that each exhale is your terminable state, the exhalation creates takes away information from your cellular body, 4.7 trillion blood cells come to your lung 8 times a minute. They leave their expression. We call CO2 in my book ECO2, a little E added, as an expression of our existence in this moment. So if anything I say about this is true, then after you do it for a while, then you begin to remember. So the truth reveals itself to you in that way. You begin to remember something about yourself. You realize it's not something you have to convince yourself. It's not something you have to learn, that this exhale is literally your terminable finality into the timeless essence of your existence. You simply become a remember about that. And that's it. So start with that, because then the rest happens automatically. Because it's only the suspect is our mind. Our mind wants to grab things and doesn't, just like that dog, wants to bite it, doesn't want to let go. Even though he knows he wants to play, he just want to go.
Yeah. And it's interesting. That is a great analogy, because no matter how bad we want to let go, it's hard for us to. Because it's been driven into us for millennia. You know, so many of these things, especially when it comes to stress and how we process the world around us, things like that, Yusuf, truly, truly come down to preternatural millennia long things that have been driven into us just as survival, and it's very much a reactionary way of thinking when truly, 95% of the time you need zero reaction.
Exactly.
You need to
like more than 90%. Yeah. I say 99%.
Yeah. Yeah. Most of the time you can just sit right there and watch it pass right by and go, huh? Interesting. Well, and that's just it. And that's where I think that idea of, and yes, it's a very simplistic term, free will, that idea of agency. What are you giving your power to? And that's the argument that I give people all the time philosophically, is if you want that person to win, you keep right on arguing with them. You are giving them every bit of your energy.
Yeah.
When what you're arguing about is absolutely insignificant. It means next to nothing in the larger term of things beyond the bruising of your own ego and your want to be right. When there is absolutely no reason to be right about any of it. There's no reason, zero reason.
For who?
For who and what reason? Is it edifying yourself more? You know, is it making you a better person? No, it's feeding your ego, which is a horrible trap to get into. And it's very interesting to get to that loss of self point, where you truly want nothing but the best for other people, even if they think different than you, even if they believe different than you. This is truly, truly a beautiful teaching, man. And since I met you a couple years ago, it's something that crosses my mind regularly. So I am so glad that you have finally put out Carbonic Artistry, that it is out there for everybody. Stop on by and get it, everybody. It's out on Amazon. We will make sure to add it to the Curious Realm store as well, where you can find everything at curiousrealm.com/store. But this is truly a life-changing teaching. It's something that when you learn that with every exhale, you have a chance to change who you are in that kind of way, and not be the same person anymore. It is a beautiful place to be. So thank you for your teaching. Thank you so much for taking the time to write this amazing book. I cannot wait to see what more you come out with. And I can't wait to have you on again and again to talk about this, Yusuf, because it's so great for us to reconnect, to refind each other, and for the book to be out. So I'm very happy for you.
And thank you for your time and your interest. It's been really educational for me. The more good questions I'm asked, the more challenges I receive, the better, the deeper all of us can be carbonically. So
that's it. That's it. We were literally putting diamonds out into the universe tonight, my friend. Ether Diamond was making them this evening. So thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your teaching. We will be in touch very soon with links, my friend. All right.
Take care, man.
Absolutely. Take care. You have a great evening, man. What an amazing conversation, folks. And truly, it is. It's the idea of that we talk about on the show all the time, that we are responsible, that we have an agency to create and put a vibration out into the universe, be it good, be it bad. We have that capability to be able to resonate in that kind of way and be able to ring like a resounding gong, whose energy never stops. It just keeps going. So remember that you can lock in your carbonic certainty into the universe around you, into every exhale. When we come back from this quick break, we will be joined by Richard Gage. We will be talking about 9/11, the tragedy that happened here on American soil 25 years ago. Many of the falsities that have been put out, many of the things that will be talked about at this year's Turning the Tide 9/11 conference in New York on the 25th anniversary. We'll be getting into that and so much more with Richard Gage right after this, folks.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO-UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. Thank you so much for staying with us. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you're a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by True Hemp Science today. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science use a spigeric process where every part of the hemp plant is used. That's every part. The buds, the seeds, the stems, the leaves, the fibers, every part. Used, combusted, reused, till nothing but an amazing Spigeric product complete with terpene profiles and all remain. Stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. That is the website that you want to go to. Curious 7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more. In this segment, we are more than pleased to welcome back to the show San Francisco Bay Area architect Richard Gage, AIA member of the American Institute of Architects and founder and former CEO of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. He now leads the charge for a new World Trade Center investigation along with his courageous wife, Gail, at RichardGage911.org. We will also be talking in this segment about the amazing Turning the Tide 25 years later. Turning the Tide 9/11. I went out to this conference last year and it was amazing. Richard, I will, number one, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure and it's always great talking with you. You are so knowledgeable on this topic. And
we'll see.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was talking with my brother just earlier today before this pre-record, and I mentioned your name, and he was like, oh, man, like you were, we found you at the same time on Art Bell years ago after this first happened. You know, and I have followed your work since even last year, whenever we first met before the conference and I had you on. It was like my fingers were all a tingle because it was one of those like, wow. You hear a lot of conspiratorial folk out there, Richard. You hear a lot of people talking about this event every year. But it's one of those there is a cadre of engineers, architects, people like yourself. That are out there that have real questions, that have true questions when it comes to structural details, when it comes to safety, when it comes to these things that not only led up to this horrific incident, but the aftermath of it and everything. So thank you for all the work that y'all have done. Thank you so much for having me out last year. It was truly an amazing event. And the one I quote it all the time whenever people ask me about the events I go to, specifically organizers, the one thing that I bring up all the time is the dissenting opinions panel. And it is one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen at any conference. And I've yet to see any other conference do it where there is a debate style timed event. Where it's like you can ask any question, any researcher can ask any other researcher a question, and you have a timed amount of time to answer it. And it is really great to see that back and forth because that's actual science. You know, that's engineering. That's how you work out problems. You've got to be able to openly ask and answer those questions. So kudos to you guys for putting that together. It really is amazing.
Thanks, Chris. We worked hard on that one.
Well,
and we're working hard on this coming one too. A lot harder.
Absolutely. Let's get into this year's conference. Where is it being held? It's in New York this year, correct?
Yeah. September 10th through the 13th, coming up next week. We're real excited about this. This is at a historic venue, and this is the El Museo del Barrio and Teatro.
Oh wow!
And on Central Park on Fifth Avenue. Very exciting venue. 40 speakers all together. Look at those speakers. I mean, you're talking, well, here, I'll share my screen too.
Please, please.
And show you what amazing talent, research, first responders, family members that we have coming here. In fact, let me start out by introducing you to the developer of World Trade Center Building 7, Larry Silverstein, who basically purchased the rest of the World Trade Center complex just 6 weeks prior to 9/11. Every day he was in the Windows of the World restaurant, every morning, without fail. I mean, this is like the first time in years that he had missed this opportunity to have his daily meeting, and he missed it because of a dermatology appointment, and you're going to hear about that here. Here we go.
Mr. Silverstein?
What is it?
You might want to see this. There's a conference happening. a conference? Why the heck do I care?
You said you wanted notified of anything about 9/11 after you saw that video, so I figured you'd want to know.
Oh, brother, here we go again.
It's called Turning the Tide, it says here. 4 days of presentations, discussions, networking, and action marking the 25th anniversary of 9/11.
I knew the anniversary wasn't going to be easy, but this...
It's from September 10th through the 13th right here in New York. It seems like a collection of experts that don't believe the official story all in one place.
A bunch of crackpot, tinfoil hat people. Who cares what they have to say anyway, right?
It doesn't seem like it. They've got some pretty important speakers.
Oh, yeah? Like who?
Jimmy Dore, Dennis Kucinich, James Corbett, Brett Weinstein, and that's not even half of them.
Oh.
There's first responders, government whistleblowers, families of the victims.
Come on.
Authors, filmmakers.
This is pretty serious.
I think even the timeline junkie guy who made that video you hate.
What? This is insane. At least they don't have like a iconic rock star speaking or something.
Well, Roger Waters from Pink Floyd will be there as well.
Shit! This is not good, Debbie.
Would you like me to buy some tickets on their website?
Ooh.
Maybe you could talk to them and clear some things up?
Oh, no, I can't. I have a dermatologist appointment to get to that I can't miss.
Oh, so, your dermatologist appointment lasts 4 days?
What's with all the questions, Debbie? You're starting to sound like them.
Oh, that is great. That is good stuff.
Definitely. Turning the Tide, 911.org, where you can learn a whole lot more. I'll be speaking there about the World Trade Center Building 7 and its explosive destruction and the Twin Towers as well. We'll be presenting, in fact, the 1,000-page report, which we were inspired to create at the invitation of Senator Ron Johnson, who came to last year's conference, which you were at, Chris, in
yep.
Washington, D.C. He is the chair of the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations and offered that platform for Senate hearings, as he's doing currently and has done with COVID. So that's pretty exciting opportunity. We'll introduce that report to everybody. We also have on Sunday a false flag day, which is pretty darn amazing.
Oh, wow.
Because, oh yeah, James Lee will be uncovering the deception around the Charlie Kirk assassination. We have the Phil Turney of the U.S. Liberty, and he'll that false flag
yep.
on the part of Israel. He is a survivor of that, one of the few left of that event. And then Derek Burrows will be uncovering the Oklahoma City bombing event and the deception there. And that's not all. Nick Bryant will be uncovering Epstein and the cover-up. His work goes back 10 years on this subject. In fact, he was the author of the Franklin scandal, which exposed congressional officials in a huge pedophilia scandal back then in the 80s or 90s. Very heavy day. In fact, the parallels between 9/11 and COVID will be covered by Mary Holland of the Children's Health Defense organization, Bobby Kennedy's organization. She's the executive director. And Meryl Nass will be looking at the anthrax deception following 9/11. She lost her license speaking up about COVID, her medical license. So this is an incredible day. Going to be my favorite because there's just a lot to learn with that, with all of these other speakers on outside of 9/11. But regarding 9/11, we have Chris Martinson.
Wow.
He's a deep thinker, analytical thinker about turning his attention to 9/11 now. And Karen Kwiatkowski, Pentagon intelligence whistleblower, very, very powerful. Brett Weinstein, a deep thinker about 9/11. Why? What does this mean for the American people that we've been scammed on such a huge level? All of these questions, what will happen in society as a result of digging into this? James Corbett will be doing some of that as well from the Corbett Report. Roger Waters of Pink Floyd has been helping Matt Campbell, the brother of murdered victim Jeff Campbell in the North Tower. They are bringing their lawsuit to the Supreme Court in the UK. Very, very exciting. Jimmy Dore been exposing 9/11 and other false flag events for years now. He's coming to speak live. He's funny. He's incisive and very relevant and courageous as a comedian. Dennis Kucinich will be also speaking yet again. The conference you went to, Chris, he was he brought the house down as the last speech. Amazing on the importance of getting to the heart of 9/11 to get to unroot the deep state in America and around the world. We also have a family member, Bob McElvain, who is the father of Bobby McElvain, murdered in this North Tower lobby with explosives that blew his body apart. He's been seeking justice for 25 years, and he's not stopping. Power, very powerful. The firefighters are amazing that are coming. Fire commissioner and fire chief, formerly Chris Gioia, will be speaking out against his epic journey for justice. And he's the star of The Responders, the film that will have its an international premiere on September 11th, right there in the conference. First time ever. These are first responders who are telling the truth about 9/11, speaking about the explosions, particularly, and many of the first responders are not, as you know, so we're delighted to have them. They'll be organized by founder of Firefighters for 9/11 Truth, Eric Lawyer, who will be introducing Patrick Dillon, for instance, first responder who saw molten metal deep down in the pile that he was descending into as a search and rescue. And he saw, he was told to get out of Building 7 by three battalion chiefs who said they're going to pull the building, everybody out, because they were taking a rest in the lobby in Building 7 early that afternoon. That was pretty fascinating. Also saw guys with guns trailing these three battalion chiefs. Very interesting. Well, Captain Richard Patterson saw the same thing when he tried to approach Building 7 in the early afternoon as well with Chief Fox. And a guy came by them and said, that building, Building 7, is coming down around 5 o'clock. More foreknowledge. Just like the BBC announcing the collapse of Building 7 20 minutes before it happened. We're going to get into. The MCs of the event are Jason Burmis, creator of Loose Change 9/11, and anesthesiologist and engineer Madhav Asetti, who graduated with Thomas Massey from MIT. Oh yeah, you know Madhava. Oh yeah, you were there.
I interviewed him. I interviewed most of who you are speaking of last year. Other than Roger Waters.
But where can people find those interviews?
All those interviews are available right there on our Curious Realm channel on YouTube. They're all available on our website. I'll send you links to them as well, Richard. I know I did whenever we did them originally, but
We should get those out.
The presentations that go on there, once again, are absolutely phenomenal because these aren't just researchers in these areas. These are engineers, physicists, people who are doing actual experimentation on this. Whereas there was no real experimentation done with the NIST documents, with the investigation from NIST, things like that. Yep. That's one of the big reasons that the movement first started, was that there was no actual science done in this scientific report.
Niels Harrod is bringing forth the science. He's the author of the Nanothermite Report that in 2009, a peer-reviewed study with seven independently collected samples from the World Trade Center dust. He analyzed them with eight international scientists and found active nanothermitic materials in the World Trade Center dust. They thought they were paint, but they're clearly not paint. And there's lots of other forensic evidence to prove that, but he'll be there talking about his theory about what really brought these towers down, how they could have managed that. Barbara Honegger will be there talking about the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry and their efforts to get a real investigation over the last 15 years. Lots of progress forthcoming. that we'll be talking about there. Also, Jonathan Cole has done, engineer, has done a film inviting everybody to consider 9/11 as False Flag Day from here forward.
Nice.
Yeah, that'll change the meme out there, and we'll all start to use that meme every 9/11 from now on. Oh, right. You mean False Flag Day?
Yeah.
The mother of all false flags, right? 9/11, where one country injures itself and blames it on another country with excuse to manipulate their people to support a war, $6.5 trillion global war on terror against particularly Afghanistan and Iraq, where the real goal is to effect regime change and steal the resources of those countries. Opium in the case of Afghanistan.
Yep. Yep.
And oil in Iraq.
Yeah, and the famous video of Geraldo Rivera out in the opium fields whenever the war first started over there, talking about like we have to help the Afghani people protect the opium fields that keep them alive.
Wait, he didn't say that, did he?
It was pretty fascinating. Yeah,
I need to see that, Chris. I've never seen that one. I've seen U.S. soldiers, pictures of them going through the opium fields. That is amazing in itself. But Geraldo Rivera,
pretty sure that's it was huge. Geraldo. Pretty sure it was.
You got to help me. We got to find that. That's important. Hey, guess what? Bill Manning, the former editor-in-chief of Fire Engineering Magazine, the magazine that brings together all the firefighters, he will be there because he wrote an article a year after 9/11 citing crucial evidence that could answer many questions is on the slow boat to China, meaning it was sent to China for recycling before investigators could get their hands on it, do a proper investigation, showing an astounding ignorance of government officials to the value of a thorough scientific investigation. The destruction and removal of evidence must stop immediately, he wrote. So, and since then, it's not like questions, it's accusations. He's on fire with the 9/11 truth. This guy, he'll be there. Rick Bielicki will be there, the New York police sergeant who arrested the drivers of the van, which had a mural of the Twin Towers being about to be hit by a jetliner. So he was called out by citizens screaming on the street about this mural after the towers were hit. So he arrests them. He's not sure what happened to them, but they were brown skinned, as he said. So, you know, who knows? Well, were they Israelis? What? Cause we know about the dancing Israelis, for instance. For those of you who don't, they were caught celebrating the collapse in real time of the towers.
Here is that clip, actually, Richard.
You found the clip already?
Oh, I'm good, buddy.
From Helmand Province is Geraldo Rivera. Good morning to you, Geraldo. Tell us what you've seen during your days there in Afghanistan.
Hi, Allison, Dave, and Clayton. Yes, in some ways, the Marines' brilliantly executed invasion of Marja, this town in the middle of Helmand province, was the easy part. The hard part now is governing this province, a province, as you suggest, that has become addicted to opium in many, many ways. That is the principal crop that is being grown here. The Taliban lend the farmers the money. They are indebted to the Taliban. They have to grow the opium. Now the Marines, in their success, are in a sense a victim of their success, because now the population is, you know, they have these opium fields and we are tolerating it. We are tolerating the cultivation of the opium because we know that if we were to destroy it now, the population would turn against the Marines and it would be a real security risk. Let me introduce.
Wow, that's a spin. CIA was funding all of that.
Absolutely.
This is incredible. I got to have that if you don't mind emailing it to me.
You bet.
Good
buddy.
Find. I never seen that. That's perfect. Because that's why Afghanistan was invaded.
It was a keystone in the whole thing.
Well, in fact, the Taliban had shut down the opium production when they came into power, down from 2,800 metric tons to about 280 metric tons per year. And then after we kicked them out following 9/11, the opium production skyrocketed to 6,000 metric tons, all under our watch. So you just, all you have to do is look at the numbers to see what the CIA and U.S. military is really doing in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
For a while, until they got kicked out themselves. Anyway, well, then we're going to have also forensic historian Richard Grove, who will be discussing the financial crimes going on around 9/11. And Xander Arena, on the board now of AE 9/11 Truth, I will be introducing him, and it's very exciting what's happening over there. He has the petition that will be fixed and running again. It'll jump from 3,600 architects and engineers demanding a new investigation up to maybe 4,000. So there's a lot of backlog that needs to be done there, and he's on it. Then we have a sociologist, Professor Rich Elifritz, who's talking about the deep societal problem as a result of the manipulation of this false flag event on us and how we can get out of it as a society. The psychologist Robert Griffin will be following him, and that is our own personal relationship to this massive deception. In my case, in 2006, when I became aware of this, my world turned upside down. I mean, up was down, down was up. If we've been scammed, this grandiose fashion, not only by our media, the government, and our institutions. I mentioned the American Institute of Architects didn't get one bulletin on this, the third worst structural failure in modern history, the AIA. It's been swept under the rug completely. So then we have a panel of early on 9/11 truthers, well before my time. They had no architects and engineers to back them up. They are just out there against this fever pitch to go to war and support our troops. And it was not a popular time to talk about 9/11, and yet they did.
No, it was not.
Carol Brulé and Mike Berger lead that crew. And that'll be very exciting to take a step back 4 years. Lucas Kaffenberger, the creator of the Lucky Larry series that you saw another piece of tonight, today, he will be there talking about this extended series that he's doing on this animated AI version of the perpetrators behind 9/11 as he sees it. Very, very funny and very exciting, too. And then Action Day is Friday, with Sandra and Jean Laritonda leading the group, going to the site of Building 7 or near there and handing out flyers for the conference and trying to wake up the people that are coming to pay their respects to the 9/11 victims and family members, just with an invitation to come to this conference and learn the truth about what really took down those towers and killed those people. Ted Walter will be there, and he'll have lots to say about several different subjects, including introducing the world premiere of The Responders, which I mentioned. So
that's
this
fantastic.
Is all pretty exciting. And guess what? Here's the venue that we're going to be at, a historic theater on Central Park, El Museo del Barrio Teatro. So come and join us, guys. And guess what? If you can't get there to New York, you can watch for free on live stream.
Fantastic.
From your own home on the redacted platform of Clayton and Natalie Morris. All 4 days streamed for free.
That's great.
That's millions of viewers that he'll bring in also. Isn't that fantastic?
That is amazing that they do that and that they help out in that way.
Yeah. And they're all over 9/11.
Yep.
Jimmy Dore, like Brett Weinstein, Tucker, even to speak of progress here from ridiculing the 9/11 truth movement 20 years ago, he's now apologized and done a 4-part series documentary on 9/11 truth. So that's pretty darn helpful, I think. here's the schedule. We start on Thursday and with all these speakers. And then Thursday, we're honoring Charlie Kirk, not so much honoring him, but exposing the murder of him by in this deceptive assassination, this false flag operation. Also, Friday, we go into remembrance and perseverance. We do the deep dive into what really happened. Saturday also, Jimmy Dore headlining the evening. And then Sunday, overcoming the deep state. That is the false flag day that I was mentioning.
I love that.
Here is the, yeah, me too. The responders. Breaking the silence, meaning the silence of explosives and controlled demolition in these towers that killed 343. That's what really killed them, not collapsing buildings due to broken columns and fires. So, and we'll prove that at the conference and on our website, richardgage911.org. You can see all the evidence of Building 7 and the Twin Towers that we've gone through in some detail. The tickets are only $150 for all 4 days. You can get single day tickets also. And if you want to rub shoulders with some of the greats, Brett Weinstein, Roger Waters, Dennis Kucinich, Jimmy Dore, Richard Gage, you can purchase a ticket that'll help fund the event because the expenses are much more than our ticket sales. So we want to seek your donations as well to make this really happen. $911 gets you to the classy brunch with the speakers, gets you a front row seat and front of the line access each day also. So yeah, join us. There's tickets each day. Students are $20. You can't beat that. So if you have an ID, definitely come. That's what I wanted to share with you about the exciting events of 9/11 this year, Chris.
Well, it truly is, once again, an amazing event, Richard. And it's one that I thoroughly loved last year when I went. And even whenever I went last year, I know when I had you on, it was one of those, I have been a questioner for decades, my friend. And it's one of those I have held since it happened. I remember I was a youth minister when it all happened, and dealing with junior high school students and with tons of questions that they had regarding this event and a world changing event. Like everything is different since then. Much like after COVID, everything is different, you know, and there's a weird reset to society. And now that we're 25 years down the line, I have had more people in the last 2 years ask me about this than ever. And I think it's much like, 25 years after JFK, people were much more willing to entreat the possibility, the horrible possibilities. You know, and I've said since the jump that at the very least, much like Pearl Harbor, there were people in our government who knew that something was going to happen and sat and did nothing for, be it the cause of moving forward an agenda, be it the cause of moving forward the Patriot Act, which set up all kinds of things for contractors in this country, from Blackwater to but Raytheon, all kinds of things came out of that. So at the very least, there was something like that. And that's horrible enough to think about. But once you start hearing the presenters at this, and once again, not people who've like been internet rabbit hole digging, Richard, these are physicists. These are actual structural engineers who build buildings, who have real questions about, like, the whole question I kept asking after last year was, did anything about the fire codes in America for buildings over 50 stories change? And the answer is no.
Well, some things changed, but no structural.
Yeah, no structural
recommendations by NIST were adopted by the International Building Code.
Yeah.
So nothing that would keep a 47-story building, for instance, from collapsing at freefall due to a few small scattered fires.
Yeah. And even those, there was somebody that I just saw on social media that was like, oh, nanothermite. Hey, folks, there's the patent, just so you know. Feel free to hop on over to Curious Realm, to the Knowledge Vault. Go to Scientific Studies. There it is right there. New nano aluminum thermite formulations.
Yeah, this was developed before 2001 by Lawrence Livermore Lab. And the same thing that they do in their studies of differential scanning calorimetry, for instance, a heater that heats up these chips, they ignite at 800 degrees Fahrenheit and produce iron microspheres, which is also discussed and found by the U.S. Geological Survey in all their studies in their particle atlas produced in 2006. They don't know where they came from, but they do come from thermite.
Yeah, and that's just it. You know, when you start digging it, and that people will be like, oh, that doesn't exist. There it is. There's the patent. Like, this is a real material. It exists. It's been used. It is used.
Would you mind sending me that patent also? I really do need to put that in my presentation, Chris. Thank you.
You bet. But these are the things that just I've dug up, and I'm no crazy insanely good investigator. I mean, I had a job for a little while where it was my job to find clips like the one with Geraldo Rivera and remember that clip in my head for all eternity.
Wow.
Never and let it go. Because my host may just randomly call for it and be like, bring up that Geraldo clip in the opium field. And perfect. You better be able to find it. It's fascinating. And the fact that y'all are having a false flag day, I absolutely love. And I wish that it was a term that didn't exist. I wish that it was a term that wasn't, it's not even our term, Richard. Like, that is an actual military term.
Yeah.
You know, made more than famous by the USS Maine. Which is the sinking of which brought us into the Spanish-American War. That is quite literally the source of the word false flag.
Well, every war, in fact, in the Western world, probably Eastern too, has been started with such a war trigger called a false flag. World War One, World War Two, the Vietnam War, all proven and through and many through declassified information to have been just that. Professor Graham McQueen did the research and says, hey, this is a war trigger system. That's how they do it. That's how Germany did it when they burned down the Reichstag. And before that and after that.
Well, and you know, even us, like you said, this was no strange modus operandi. This was an actual MO that was come up with by the CIA years ago, and one of the precepts that we were going to use to invade Cuba was the idea of doing bombings on American soil and blaming them on foreign governments as a pretense to go to war or just go to invasion, because it'd be a country like Cuba that we could swoop in and take over pretty quick. You know,
this was declassified as Russia. The North.
Yeah.
Ah. And the Northwoods project, it was declassified and proven. And John F. Kennedy turned down that. He says, no, we're not going to do this.
Yeah.
We're not going to pretend to shoot down a plane full of college students and use it as a pretext to bomb Cuba. And then they took him out.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And that's another one that, looky there, we have it right there in the Knowledge Vault. There's the actual program documents from it. And those were things that we found out about in the church committee hearings with MK Ultra and stuff like that, you know, where we found out that these were plans that they'd had for a long time. So it's fascinating to see some of these things, some of these old hat tricks still being used, Richard, that they are still fully alive and well. And I remember, God, it was, I brought this up earlier while you were talking as well, because you mentioned Oklahoma City. And I remember years ago in my previous incarnation, before we became Curious Realm, we were Dudes and Beer. But one of the shows that got us an award was we had a whistleblower named Cody Snodgrass come on, who claimed to have been offered $1 million by the CIA to blow up the Murrow Building in Oklahoma City.
I heard about him. And then he blew the whistle on him.
I've never heard from him again, Richard. The guy who brought him to me has never been able to track him down again.
Oh.
Like, I have wanted to get him back on the show, man, and this guy is ghost. But
well, I hope that's
the episode's out there. It exists. And it is it's one of the only times where, like, I literally stepped back. I was like, there is so much going on with this story. I will maybe have two questions, but the microphone is yours. Much like whenever you come on and give your presentation, it just behooves to just let you give the presentation. It is so much better than interrupting it with questions, you know. And the only other time I ever let that happen was when, like, Anonymous asked me to use my show as a platform to announce their hacking of the Minneapolis Police Department after George Floyd. And that was one of the only times I was like, the microphone's being turned over. Somebody else has the controls tonight.
Well, what did they learn from the Minneapolis Police Department?
Oh, they found all kinds of corruption. It was fascinating. Yeah.
Wow.
That was a really wild night. I remember a security friend of mine was swatting people away from my server all night while we were going live. It was interesting. But
wow.
These things exist. These things happen. These things are still black bag tricks that are used as means to go to war, as motive to go to war, Richard. And as we get ready to let you go, because I know you've got to go early this evening, things like that, you're actively preparing to go to the conference. What can people do to get involved? I always say question everything, question often, and read. Once again, my job with this show and so many things is not only to demystify, but to be a proper skeptic, Richard, to be looking for the data that changes my mind. And I found data last year amongst the people that I interviewed that changed my mind about a lot of things when it came to 9/11. And as nefarious as I thought things were, it seems like it's so much more nefarious after learning those things and after just hearing it from the mouths of physicists and mathematicians and people with the science behind them of engineering. It's frightening, Richard. So what can people do to find out more? What can people do to attend the conference, and what can people do to get involved?
Yep, those are great questions. And I encourage people to learn more at richardgage911.org. And you can learn more about the conference there. You can learn more about our ongoing seminars like Gaza and 9/11, mm-hmm. the parallels, another false flag operation. You can learn more about the crime scene to courtroom. And that is 9/11 crime scene to courtroom, our 12 episode series. We've done 6 already. We're in the boardroom. Mick Harrison and I of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry are presenting this evidence to a sitting grand jury. It's pretty exciting. So I encourage you to check that out as well.
Okay.
And the important thing is to share this podcast, because you don't know who the person you might be sharing with knows in New York, Connecticut, New Jersey. Yeah. Who needs this information and who would go. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. This won't happen again. This is the 25th anniversary of 9/11. We're pulling out all the stops, and it's just way too much work to to repeat. So
yeah,
it's historic. So get there and share this podcast and all of Chris's podcasts.
Well, thank you.
With people who, yeah, you, Chris can put it out there, but he can't do what you can do, which each one of you, which is share it,
yeah,
and reach therefore millions with these truths.
Well, and Richard, you know, once again, it's one of those, explore the topic, folks. Be open-minded about it. At 25 years, there is a different conversation going on. And I am so happy to see that. I'm happy to see people like Tucker Carlson, who once poo-pooed the topic and said, no way. It's exactly as the story says. It's exactly as the narrative says. It's exactly as NIST says. I'm glad to see him making a pivot and saying, no, yep, there's something else to this. I'm glad to see people like Dennis Kucinich behind this. I'm glad to see people like Roger Waters behind this, because, yeah, you know, people like him helping families fight for the justice that they're trying to get is massively important and brings a different lens to all of this. Because it's one thing, it's one thing for a scientist to say something. It's another thing for an artist to get behind a family and say something has been wronged to them. Something has gone wrong here, and we are trying to find a form of justice for them. That is a big step forward and a beautiful step in this cause. So I'm glad that you guys have been able to garner that from him. That's great.
Thank you, Chris. Yeah. We're very excited to have him on the stage with everybody else. And you can have brunch with Roger Waters. Just join us as a VIP candidate, a VIP ticket holder. We'd love to have you. $911 supports the organization, the conference project that we're, you know, the tickets only cover like half the cost. So let's get on it, folks, and help out in any way you can. And be sure to watch on live stream at Clayton Morris's Redacted on YouTube. And you can watch it right here, of course, RichardGage911.org and TurningTheTide911.org.
And International Center for 9/11 Justice as well.
Yep, you can watch it there too.
It's so fantastic, the coalitions that have come together to put this amazing event on. I am so entirely sad that I am not there this year, Richard, but know that I am there in heart, I am there in spirit, and anytime any of you guys need a platform, we are always here for you.
Thank you, Chris. That's awesome.
Absolutely.
Appreciate it so much.
You bet. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience, Richard. While you are online checking out everything over at RichardGage911.org and getting your tickets to Turning the Tide 9/11 in New York, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all of the embedded YouTube channels of our guests, as well as the classified knowledge vault. If you go to /knowledge at Curious Realm, you can find all of our declassified government documents, scientific documents like the patents that we were talking about. That is also where you can find your link to Curious Research, folks, and our brand new CromFit, the Curious Research Online Media File Inspection Tool. If you're an investigator looking to check out the forensics of photography, videography, audio to see if it has been edited, doctored, anything like that, this is an online tool that is absolutely free. It costs nothing. Your files do not go into a server. They are processed locally by your browser and then deleted. So uber private. A great way for investigators out there to be able to process their data, to be able to look at their data, to be able to examine data given to them by witnesses to help maintain its veracity. So thank you so much, everybody, for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit GroundZeroPlus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious, and remember, the other side is always watching.